My pleasure to introduce our main speaker, Jimmy T. from San Diego.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Hi, everybody. My name is Jimmy. I'm an alcoholic. Got stuff to read up here. I'm also told I can talk to till 8:25 to 8:27. Somewhere in there. I have a lot of leeway. And I'll make it. You know, if you see, I have great fear of going over and having a trap door I'm standing on open up, and I slide down into the basement and wind up at the CODA meeting or some deal like that, and I don't want to do that. Mark, good job, wherever he went. There he is. Yeah, good job. What I usually talk about is what we used to be like, what happened, and what's now. And you know, so many people, they get up here and they say what it was like. You know, and it's not what the damn book says. The book says what we were like. And you know, you can have somebody that lives on the highest hill in Las Vegas with the biggest house and the best cars and airplanes and boats, and that person doesn't really have a lot in common with the guy that's wandering around on Skid Row and has his entire estate in a shopping cart. But what is the same is the way they feel. It's the way you feel when you're an alcoholic and you get down to the end, there's nothing else to do. And that's when that moment of willingness comes around. For those of us who are fortunate enough to make it, yeah, I apologize for my voice. I don't know what happened to it, but sometimes it sounds like a herniated frog, and sometimes like, I don't know, like a squirrel or something. So if you can't hear it, you maybe scoot up a little bit. There's an empty chair next to our beautiful secretary. Anyway, thank you guys for the invitation, and thank John. John Cloud and I have known each other since we're about 24 years now. John lived in San Diego most of the, or all that time. And I'm going to tell you something about what happened with him and his little group. There were, I believe, six of these guys. They came in together. They got the same sponsor. And I never saw a single one of those guys without a coat and tie on or just a tie helping, doing a job at the meeting. They always had service. Every single time, and they were always there, willing to help. And, you know, as a result of that, 24 years later, I understand one guy had a slip, but the rest of them are all sober. 24 years, and they're all sober, and they're all involved in service. So if you're thinking about what you want, if you're new, you might want to think about that. Get involved in service right away. I don't think, you know, I don't believe that I've ever not had a job in AA. When I got sober, I was really a mess. And my first job was that of a coffee maker's assistant. And I'm serious. They did not feel that I could actually make a pot of coffee. And I probably agree with them. But you see, the one thing that I learned, the one thing that I knew, is that if for some reason I didn't show up, they would have to cancel that meeting. So, you know, at first I didn't, you know, sometimes I didn't want to go, I didn't feel good, and I have to say, I gotta go because they won't have a meeting without me. And I've always had service. It's always been a part of, and it's a huge part. It's been a huge part in me developing my personality in AA. I am just not the same person that came here. And anyway, I talk about my background. I'm a fifth generation alcoholic. My dad, his dad, two more generations, and that's as far back as I can trace it. There may be others, I don't know. Our family crest features a wine bottle and a pair of handcuffs. And our motto, our family motto is, you really don't understand. And it served us well. My dad was a drunk. He was a working drunk. And him and I had an off-again, on-again relationship. I was involved in athletics a lot when I was a kid. And, you know, we'd go home from a ball game, and you'd see all the other kids. Their dads would put them on their shoulders or pick them up. My dad never touched me. And even as a little kid, that used to bother me. And he would do, you know, he'd do other things. Like every time I went to jail, he was there to get me out. And when I got older, I got to return the favor. And that's called male bonding in our family. But, you know, these are the things that I just haven't, you know, my relationship was strained, and then it got worse. My mom didn't drink. She was a saint of a woman, and she really was. She was a great gal. She had one little thing that she had. She had to do something with all this pressure. She's got an alcoholic son. She's got a daughter with all kinds of emotional difficulties, and she got married to an alcoholic. So what the hell is she going to do? One of my friends or somebody left a shoebox full of firecrackers at our house one time. This is when I'm young. And she figured out that if she lit a firecracker off during times of stress, she would actually feel better. And that went on for quite a while. And one of my friends, a military guy, left a diver recall bomb, which is about a third of a stick of dynamite. And she lit it one time. I can't remember what the occasion was, but God, what a noise. You know, nobody in our family could hear for about a week. And, you know, you could smell that thing. You know, she threw it on the rug is what she did. And there was no rug there for a while, you know. It was, but that's how she got through life. You know, I started to drink when I was really young. I got drunk for the first time when I was about 14 years old, and I was down in Mexico spearing fish. And I got drunk. It was the best thing that ever happened to me. I felt great. There was no pressure. There was no anything. I just felt good. And I couldn't understand why anybody else would not do that, because it felt so damn good. Or like Mark said when he was talking, is I had a lot of fun drinking. I did too. I had a hell of a lot of fun drinking, and I personally believe that if you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and you didn't have any fun drinking, you got screwed. And you know, I did. I got in a lot of little tiny times of trouble. Myself and a bunch of other guys, we didn't have any goals in life, I don't think. Everybody else was making plans and going to school, and we just wanted to get drunk. And one of the things we had that would come up now and then, it was a little saying that I used to do. It was, "Hey, I got an idea." And every time you heard that, it was going to result at least in a court appearance and perhaps some jail time. And, you know, they're just little silly-ass things. We're going over to Coronado one time, which, if you've never been to San Diego, it's a little island there on the other side of the Strand. And we were on the ferry. Now, for you young people, that kind of ferry I'm talking about is a boat. And it carried cars and people. And we're on the thing, and we're in the front row. And as we start to pull into Coronado, one of my buddies goes, "Hey, I got an idea. Let's moon these guys." And that was one of the stupidest things anybody ever said. But we did it anyway, you know. It was, by God. And, you know, I don't really think any of us realized how sensitive the people that live in Coronado are. Because by the time that boat docked, there were cops everywhere. And we all went off to the Coronado City Jail, which remains my, you know, I had just gotten out of the Tijuana jail, so it was an upscale experience for me. And it still remains my favorite jail that I was ever in. And I had a judge tell me one time, I can't, oh yeah, I do know what I was doing. I was drunk walking around, and do you remember those S&H green stamp things? Now I found one of them and I put it in front of a mortuary. And so I just thought that was the best place for it, I guess. And when I went to court over that, the judge who knew me looked at me and said, Taylor, in my chambers right now. And I went back there with him and he said, you know something? You're not a criminal. You're just a screw up. And he says, what you do is you come in here, you waste my time, you waste the court's time, you waste everybody's time. You're nothing but a pest. Now get out of here. And he let me go. And it was a blow to my ego, I'll tell you that. I thought I was a criminal of some kind, and I never was. I just wasn't. And, you know, my life went on like that. I got the best damn job a guy like me could have. I've always had a relationship with the ocean, and I'm running a dive shop. Running a dive shop, teaching diving, and this is the stuff I live for, being in the water. And I was doing this and having a wonderful life. I got married, we had a couple of kids. I am just doing perfectly. And then I was in an accident. And the accident, I got a terrible blow to the head, and it left me with epilepsy, the grand mal kind, the kind that just did not respond to treatment of any kind, medications, any of that stuff. And I go from one day of teaching diving, running a dive shop, being underwater a few hours a day, to no, nothing. I can't do that. I can't go diving. I can't run anything. I can't drive a car, climb a ladder, do anything. And that was one of the most painful parts of my life, because for the next number of years, I just felt sorry for myself. I had figured out by then that that was the worst thing that ever happened to anybody in the history of this world. And all I did is I got myself a bottle and crawled in. And that was one of those things that I started drinking in the morning. As soon as I got up, I had to drink. And I quit drinking as I passed out. Get up the next day and do the same damn thing. Every sober breath was spent feeling sorry for myself. And what happened, this is for some of you who are maybe just starting your relationship with this program, is one day I wake up and I had a vomit, which not unusual, but it came out bright red. So I had to go to the hospital. And in the hospital, they opened me up and they fixed the leak. That's not a medical term, but they fixed the leak is what happened. And they put me in the hospital, and in a couple of days, I'm ready, three or four days, I'm ready to go home. Doctor comes in, and the last thing he says is, Jimmy, you cannot drink anymore. It's going to kill you. And I looked at that doctor, and I said, Doctor, I am never going to drink again. And I meant it. No, I mean, I was serious. And it didn't work. I was drunk in a week. I'm back in there another time, squirting blood, and I go in, and the same drill, go to the surgery, come out of surgery, and they move, this one I should have quit then, but they move you from the intensive care to the standard or substandard care, wherever you go. And the way they do that is that four nurses, each one grabs a leg or an arm, and they slide you onto a gurney from where you were. And they go, one, two, three, and one of those angels of mercy was standing on my catheter. And it's a pain I can remember to this very damn day. And The doctor gave me the same thing, and I told him the same thing. And I told him, "Doctor, I'll never drink again." And I had about a week staying sober. There's something about being sober or not drinking because of fear that is not, has no longevity. You know, that fear is transitory. The worst situation, okay, I got all of this stuff happening. I just, you know, I had the worst day of my life. All this stuff happened to me. I'm not going to drink again because I'm afraid. Well, in a few days, that fear goes away. And it talks about it in the book. As the alcoholic is unable to recall with sufficient force the suffering of a month or a week ago. He is without defense against the first drink. So I didn't have anything work for me until a few years later when I got here for the absolute right reasons. But back during that time, I had 12 abdominal surgeries identical to that. And then a whole bunch of other stuff, all from the alcoholic. But without my shirt on, it looks like I got my ass kicked by Zorro. There's scars all over my belly. It still hadn't gotten me going. The state of California took a look at me right then and said, "Boy, you got some troubles." And they became my higher power. And they put me away. I went through a lot of those things where they put you in a psych unit on a hospital. They finally put me into a mental institution. And I was there for almost 2 years. I didn't stay there that long because I was good at making moccasins or anything like that. You know, as a matter of fact, all I ever did there is I got shock therapy, which is something you don't do to people that have epilepsy. But, you know, I think it was probably a Sunday and a couple doctors sitting around, you know, and they got nothing to do, they're bored, and Warden goes, "Hey, I got an idea." And that's where it came from. They lit me up, you know, "Let's light this guy up, see what happens." I never made moccasins. I made a belt once. And I've still got it. It's a belt that, I've still got it. And, in the evening sometimes when, my wife and I are having dinner, party, people are over visiting, and they start to talk about lifetime achievements. And that is when my wife will go on in and pick up my belt for everyone there to admire. Yeah, it's a proud moment for both Pat and I. What happened? I better get sober here right now. Yeah, I got 25 to 27 minutes. I got that little 2-minute thing here that I'm working on. I was moved from the nut house to a regular hospital. I got very, very sick. And when I was in that hospital, something happened. And it was one of those things we call the burning bush. It was an immediate spiritual awakening. If it wasn't a burning bush, it was at least smoldering leaves or some damn thing like that. But something happened. And what happened, I woke up. One day I'm in the bed and everything's the same, but it doesn't seem the same. And I know right then that I am powerless over alcohol. Now, I had spent many years defending my right to drink, defending my alcohol abuse. And at that time, laying in that bed, I knew that I was powerless over alcohol, and this is not something I could play with. This is something that was life and death, and it was right now. And I know a lot of people say they have trouble with the second half of the first step. Well, I'd been locked up for a couple years, and there's really no way that I could say my life was manageable. You know, it's pretty damn unmanageable when you got that little wristband on you, you know, and you're staying there. So I didn't know it, but I'd taken the first step. Admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Lives were unmanageable. I had taken that, and I didn't know it. Now, this is in the same deal. I knew two guys. These guys were kind of like me. You know, they're just the real bottom feeders. And they got sober in AA. And I heard about it. I heard one of them even got a job. Jeez. I didn't know if I was going to do that, but it sounded good. And I know these guys weren't lying. They did get sober. And I went to, I got to thinking, and I decided that I was going to turn my will. All right, I knew about this. You know, I became aware of this, that AA could do things because of these two yo-yos that I used to know. And I didn't realize it, but I'd taken the second step. You know, since I've gotten old, I have a brain disease. That's no kidding. And my head doesn't work very well. I can't believe that a power greater than me could restore me to sanity. I can't believe I can't remember that. But it happens. I have something called white brain, and it's my big parts of my brain are completely occluded with plaque. And unfortunately, one of those is a memory part, and it gets hard for me to remember things. Anyway, I made a decision right there that as soon as I got out of that hospital, I was going straight to AA, and I was going to do whatever you guys asked me to do. And that's the third step. Made a decision to turn will our lives over the care of God as we understood Him. And some of the most important were the four words. As we understood Him. That's what gives us the leeway in this program. That's how come the Catholics and the Baptists can sit together. And it's because this is not, it's not religion. Religion divides people. This is spirituality, and it does the opposite. It brings people together. We were over at Rick's house having dinner tonight. You know, and John tells me they get up to 50 people there. That's the fellowship, and it's important too. I've heard people say, "Well, you know, I believe in the program, but not the fellowship." You know, yeah. It doesn't make any sense. You know, what the heck? Somebody's going to get drunk if you go to a potluck. You know, it just doesn't make any sense to me. But over there, everybody's eating. He's kind enough to put this on. And what they're doing is getting this meeting ready to go. So the two, the fellowship and the program, come together because they're getting the meeting ready to go. I couldn't go to AA right away because I couldn't walk. I got out of that hospital and I was just about dead. And they took me, over to my mom's house, and I stayed there for about a month. And then I felt I could walk again. And I walked into my first AA meeting. And the thing I remember, the very first thing I remember, was the laughter. I could hear it before I got up to the building. I could hear people laughing. And that was really attractive to me. I walked in the door, and a man comes up to me, and he said, "You can't stop drinking, can you?" I mean, I didn't know how he knew I was a newcomer. I used to smoke cigarettes a long time ago, and I didn't have any clothes that didn't have little holes in them. And I hadn't shaved in about 6 months. I got this ratty, really ratty beard. It was just I couldn't keep losing blood. And Anyway, this guy comes up to me, and I'm obviously new. And he asked me that question, "You can't stop drinking, can you?" And I told him the answer. I was honest with him like I had never been honest with people since as long as I could remember. I told him, "No, I can't." And what he said to me was, "Well, neither can I, but together we can." That made sense to me. And I sat down. I went to my first AA meeting. Back then, I had auditory hallucinations for the first year, and I'm trying to make friends, so I'm just answering everybody I hear. You know, hi, the other one, really? No kidding, boo. And these people, nobody wants to sit next to me because they don't want to listen to this guy, they want to listen to the speaker. And I was just sitting there yakking away. And I shook so bad. I was like that Ready Kilowatt guy, the electrical symbol. You know, if somebody come near me, I go, ah! Coffee would go up, and nobody wanted to sit next to me because they wanted to hear the speaker, and they preferred to stay dry. And I was there, and I listened. I had an incredible gift the first year. I was unemployable. And that was the Lemon Grove Alano Club. I got there at 6 in the morning when it opened, and I left at midnight when it closed. I went to every meeting I could, and the rest of the time I sat around the kitchen and talked to the guys that had been sober long. I spent every day doing that, and I did it for the longest time. And I remember as soon as I first got moving around, I remember this guy offered me a ride. He said, you have a ride? I said, no, I'll walk, I guess. And he said, well, jump in, I'll give you a ride. And we got going down the road, and he said, where do you live? And I said, I'm not sure. And I couldn't remember where I lived. And so he said, okay, and we'd drive a little while, and he'd stop. He'd say, you see anything familiar? No. He'd drive a little more. See anything familiar? Oh, that thing, that's a fire hydrant there everywhere. Finally, after about 45 minutes, we found my mom's house where I was staying. And I got home. And see, I'll tell you how screwed up I was. The Lemon Grove Alano Club is on Central Avenue in Lemon Grove. My mom lived on Central Avenue in Lemon Grove. I was just down the street, but somehow I got it screwed up. And there was another guy that started giving me rides, and I'm not aware of what's going on, but this guy tells me he gave me a ride home from that club 7 days in a row, and on that last day, I looked at him and said, have I ever met you before? I was really a mess. But as much as there was, that's what was there to work with. And I remember when I got to thinking I might make it, I was just around 30 days sober. And I was sitting in this little tiny meeting, just like one of those, the standard AA table. You put about six people around it or eight people. I'm sitting there, and there's about half a dozen of us. And I happen to be sitting on one end of the table. And on the other end of the table is a guy sitting there, and he's got this big parrot, one of those white ones, like Beretta head. And that is a good-looking bird, and I want to say something about it. I really want to say, hey, that's a great-looking bird. But I'm afraid if I say something like that, if I say, hey, I really like that bird, he's going to look at me and say, what bird? Because I had a long history of seeing things you folks were not privileged enough to see. So I kept my mouth shut, and thankfully, this guy had been around for a long time. He shared. He goes, hey, look, that guy's got a bird. I said, damn, I might make it here. I just might make it. And I got a little challenge, and a few days after that, I had a seizure. I had a seizure in the club during the noon meeting, which had a little over 100 people at it. And there's something about epilepsy. I could never go back to a place where I'd had a seizure. I don't know if people always looked at me funny, or my imagination, or hell, I never went back there. I don't know what they looked, but I could never go back. Now here I am, I haven't had a drink in 30 days. And at that time, I walked into this thing. And now how can I go back? I can't not go back because there's 30 days of sobriety. So I put together every little bit of energy and every little bit of courage I had, which certainly wasn't much, and I went back in. And about a dozen people come up and grabbed me and shook my hand and hugged me, and I found out there were a couple of people that thought they knew where I lived and were knocking on doors. You see, that's Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's the love we have in AA. It's not something you find other places. I had that, and hell, those things became part of the meeting. You know, I'd have them frequently, and I'd bring the AA rescue squad out. There's a, you know, I think you have to weigh 250 pounds to join that. You know, and I'd go down, they'd, yeah, get him, help. You know, put a chair in his mouth. Put a bag over his head. Don't let him, I don't know if you guys thought I was going to escape or what, but I'd be laying there, I have all these people on top of me. Ken D, a friend of John's and mine, well, if you have speakers from around, I'm sure he's been here, but Ken, yeah, he weighed about 250 pounds then, and he's on top of me along with somebody else thinking they're doing good stuff, and I can hardly breathe. And I'd come out of that about this thick and about like that wide, looked like a halibut. Both eyes on one side. But, you know, what had happened is all that power just got pulled right away. You know, I've heard every damn epileptic joke there is. You know, I've got, what do you do if an epileptic has a seizure in your bathtub? Throw your clothes in. Yeah, I didn't say they were good. They're not. They're crappy. But I sure heard a lot of them. And, you know, it's just AA did what it needed to do. 2 years after that, I'd had a period of about 3 or 4 months. And it was time for me to go see the doctor again, the neurologist. I went in there to see him, and I said, you know, now it was a little longer than that. I was a little over 2 years sober. And I said, Doctor, I have really changed my life. I don't drink anymore, and, you know, my life's different. What are the chances of these things just stopping? And he looked at me, and he said, nil. He was kind of an upbeat guy. Anyway, he said, I got to do an electroencephalogram, a brainwave test. And he called me a couple days later and he said, Jimmy, I don't understand this. I have no answer for you, but your brainwave pattern is markedly improved. And I don't have the answer. You know who's got it? We do. In the book, it says when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. Since then, I've never had another seizure. I don't take medication. I can drive a car. I can even go diving. I can do whatever I want to do. It was removed from me by that power greater than myself. One of the things I had to do is I had to get a sponsor right away. I'm not one of those people that says, you know, take 2 years to do the first or second step or any of that. You know, I get them done. You know, if you read in the beginning of the book, we talk about the first 100 people that got sober. And it says, here are the steps we took as if we did this. Now, most of those people weren't more than about 30, 45, 60 days sober. And they had already done them. And that's what I found. I had to find myself a sponsor. Uh-oh, it's getting on a clock. And I finally found one. And it wasn't easy. I had a bunch of people tell me they were moving. Same people I saw around there forever. They still are there. And I got this guy. And we sat down and we talked. And this guy... we talked about the things drunks talk about. You know, like when you're driving the car, you got to slam the brakes on and there's 200 beer cans come rolling up and getting your way. Or, you know, just what was your best, what did you like to drink? Everything. You know, what was the best jail you were in? Coronado. What was the worst? Tijuana. You know, stuff like that. We're talking about things only alcoholics know about. Huh? Only us alcoholics know about things. And I knew right then that this guy had done what I had done. He was the real deal. And that was my sponsor. And I got it done. And in 6 months, I'd finished all 12 steps and was at the point where it's time for me to keep practicing in the rest of my life. I've had some challenges in my life. I've had, in my life, I have had 37 surgeries. I've had 6 strokes, 2 heart attacks, and a bout with cancer. You know, I don't know, I'm still here. The only thing I can think of is I'm doing a wonderful job and God wants to keep me here. Of course, if you ask my wife, she says, he's going to keep you here until you get it right. You're going to be here forever. So that's, she don't know nothing. So I don't know what's going to happen. You know, this thing with my brain is the latest thing, you know. But I do know that if it ends tomorrow, I will have been given a wonderful ride, a very wonderful ride. So when I was sober about 2 years, 3 years, I guess, 2 years, I don't know, sometime back then, you know, I can't even remember the second step today, so how am I going to know what happened 20-some years ago? I noticed there was a lot of people at the meeting who were introducing themselves as newcomers, and they're people that had been there 2, 5, 10, 20 years, and they went out and drank. And I got really concerned. So I went around to ask a couple of the people whose opinion I really valued. And the first one I asked was this guy named Gucci Phil. And they call him that because of the way he dressed. He'd gone to an Ivy League college, and he talked weird. Anyway, I went up and I said, Gooch, listen, you know, I'm sober and we're here. And I said, what happens that we get this stuff and it's a part of our life and then we throw it away? Why do we do that? And here's what he told me. He said, Jimmy, if you got a dog, you can have the finest dog in the world. But if you take him down to the beach and he sees a dead fish, he's going to roll in it. And I said, thanks, Scooch. That was probably 23 years ago. And to this day, I don't know what the hell it means, but that's what he told me. But I talked to some other guys, and you know, for some reason, we just quit doing what we were doing. And it's not a secret, it's nothing. We just quit doing what we were doing. I have a good friend, a speaker. He was 26, 27 years sober, and he just went out and got drunk. And I'm talking to him, and he said, you know, I just forgot. I forgot that all of the steps, this whole program applies to me. Not just to new people, not just to the regular people in the meeting, you're a big time speaker. This is what I have to be very careful doing this, because there's a way to get really thinking you're important, and that's not the case. But anyway, he'd gone out and drank, and these people, you know, this guy's back, but how many don't come back? How many, now who in the hell was I talking, Ben? We're talking about this. About the guys that come and they just want to keep putting off looking for that sponsor, keep putting off taking those steps. And the time multiplies on itself. At the end of the damn year, they haven't done anything. And therefore, they are not prepared when something comes up. You know, they're just out, they're out of the league. And when something happens, they have no defense against it. You know, there's a part of our book that I really like. And, oops, excuse me. Oh, God, I'm getting down. No, I got 7 minutes. Okay. Where are Our book tells us that we're granted a daily reprieve. It's not monthly, weekly, annually. It's a daily reprieve contingent upon the maintenance of our spiritual condition. God, that's what it's all about, right there. Maintenance of our spiritual condition. And that's the road. And, you know, it doesn't mean that if I don't go to an AA meeting every day, I'm going to get drunk. That just doesn't happen, you know. But as long as I stay on the path, stay involved with this program, stay close to the power greater than myself, it's a deal that's going to work for me forever. It's like this, kind of. It's like if you got a boat with a little tiny leak in it, and all you got to do is bail it. You know, you got a coffee can there and bail it out and you can go sailing. But for some reason, I get too arrogant, too lazy, too whatever. And I just decide, screw it, I don't want to put that bailing. I don't want to do that. I'm going sailing. Well, if I keep doing that, my boat is going to sink. And that's what's happening with these people. We have to stay involved with this stuff. This meeting has impressed the hell out of me. I am serious. Over at Rich's house, and this meeting, the way it's set up, you do this thing. I mean, these are great things. I'm sure you've got good representation in service. I'm just finishing up as a DCM for District 10 in San Diego over in Area 8. And I don't know how to encourage people to get into service. Service is anything from being a coffee maker's assistant to doing some really important things like being part of the general service. And then some of us do this. This doesn't mean any more than making coffee. It doesn't mean any more than being the secretary or being a member of a group. I'm getting right up on there now. Mm-hmm. I can see it. This thing's starting to creak. It's getting ready to open. I want to thank each and every one of you for the opportunity to come over here, see my old friend John, and to meet a bunch of new friends. And I'm just really glad to have been a part of this. I don't know, some places the energy that you guys have here is strangely missing. And you guys got it good. I didn't do that. Did you do that? Uh-huh. He wants me to quit before 8:25 to 27. But you guys have an incredible start. I hear this meeting's only 7 years old. You guys are doing fantastic, and keep it up. I hope to be seeing some of you guys come on over there to San Diego, and maybe we'll be able to attend a meeting together, or maybe you want to come all the way over. We got a guy here that comes to all of our roundups in the spring, the San Diego convention. I don't know where he is. He's around here somewhere. But come on over sometime. And I honestly hope that if you come over to visit us, we will have the good graces to treat all of you even half as nice as you treated me. Thank you very much.